us are people who grew up being interested in what used to be considered niche genres of music. Both of us built our identities as young men around that music, I think, or like largely. But we didn't do a perfect clinically historian job of absorbing those genres. There's holes in our understanding of rap, metal, and hardcore, and ska. We're here to fill them. All holes filled. It's a part of the Border Boss universe, and we just decided we're going to spin it out to another episode because we just want to keep blabbing like old men about what we don't understand about youth culture. But this is in the difference is that some of this is our own youth culture. So each of us will pick one personal album and one general album. The personal is something we're actually interested in knowing about from our own formative genres. But the general album is anything goes. Anything that someone of our generation would consider. Like if someone who is from your ilk or your age or your race or demographic, whatever, if they sidle up next to you and they want to discuss like Pet Sounds or $3 Bill Y'all or, you know, Airplane Over the Sea, one of those, they'd expect me and Mike to have heard about it. But oops. We skipped that because, you know, we're too busy with Mucky Pup. Both of us. Both of us were too busy with Mucky.
The first one I'm going to do is my general one. And I mean, I guess you could say this is personal too, but not really to me. I didn't think this is something I needed to listen to complete my taste. Technically. Because I think this is more modern. This is from 2014. And it's a band called Code Orange. And it's a record called I Am King. This is a band, I mean, I'm familiar with them. Basically, the story is, I always heard, because they used to be called Code Orange Kids, and I assumed they were like Cold War kids who were a shitty, you know, like emo-ish type group.
I would have thought pop punk. Code Orange Kids, I just would have thought they were like a
SoCal. Maybe that's what Cold War kids, I guess that, yeah. Either way, yeah, I thought it was like some kind of bullshit like that, so I was like, yeah, fuck them. And I think after a while, I kind of figured out they weren't that, they were an actual heavy band, and about... Oof. Honestly, like I think it was about 3 to 4 weeks before I Am King came out, I saw Code Orange, and I was like, oh, they're really fucking, like, they're one of those bands you see and you're just like, these guys are gonna be big. And you could just tell they're fucking tight, honk honk, but you know, you could just tell they have that thing, even though they have a drummer that sings, which is usually outside of Phil Collins, it's kind of a dead end for a band. But
yeah,
I saw them at This Is Hardcore Fest, and they, between every song, the singer drummer kept saying that, you know, it was great being a hardcore band and blah blah blah, and I honestly
it's so great to be a hardcore band.
Yeah, I, you know, just shit like that. And I don't know if he, like, I didn't, like, to this day I don't know if he was being sarcastic or if he really truly believed Code Orange Kids were a hardcore band. And that's what always kind of like confused me by him, because even from the one set that I watched, I was like, this is by far not a hardcore band. But they were embraced by the hardcore scene, so, you know, if they consider themselves metalcore or hardcore or whatever, I'm fine with it. I just, you know, I was like, they're really good, I'll get around to hearing their record. I never did. I never bothered. I've heard I've heard songs. Yeah. I've liked all of their
stuff.
They're
Grammy nominated, Mike. Yeah. Like, the first Grammy nominated hardcore band in the world.
I know, and I just never got around to listening to it, because I was like, eh, you know, there's probably bands that are better now, so whatever. Never got around to it. They kind of do like weird arena rock now. Like,
yeah,
they have a, I think they have a song with like Slipknot on their new record. Just like shit that does not sound cool anymore. But, you know, people still say they're pretty good.
Yeah.
So I figured I should listen to this record finally. And I did. And, you know, it's pretty good. I honestly don't have an overwhelming lot to say about it. I thought it was pretty good. It's kind of strange listening to it in hindsight, because if you told me, going, like, if I heard this from day one, I would not be like, this is the record that's gonna break a band. It's like, it's a good record, but it's not like, I listened to it a few times and there's nothing there where I'm just like, man, you know, I see what happened here. I feel like Zabalba had a record that came out right around the same time, and if you told me one of these bands was gonna make it big, I would have picked Zabalba 100 times out of 100. And they have more of like a flashy sound. This band is just like, it's crazy. Like, it's kind of, so I'm babbling already, but basically I feel like now that there are so many more levels of fame and celebrity and whatever you can have as a musician, and I don't think any of them equal financially how much something 20 years ago equals, but so like Code Orange to me is in that level of like top five, where like it's not, you wouldn't be shocked if a mom knew who Code Orange was, because they're fucking nominated for a Grammy.
Right.
So they're not like
Billboard.
Yeah, they have a fucking billboard, so they're not like a super underground band anymore. So just to be at that level and sound like this, it's kind of just like, I guess. I mean, it's kind of cool that, to me, coming into this, I would say, if I had to make any comparison, I would say it sounded like, it was like that kind of like early 2000s like Relapse approach to metal, where it was like, let's just take a little out of a few genres and make a band out of it. And that's kind of what this is. Like, there's the hardcore parts, and there's like really slow, doomy dirge parts that you would never expect a very popular band, a Grammy-nominated band, to ever have. There's a lot of those forced, like, ooh, vocals, which... Ooh.
Yeah. I love that when a mosh part starts with just the bleh.
Yeah. And the guy's really trying. And I mean, it's like, I don't know, it's like a solid record. I would have never picked this. I guess I should go back and listen to their like earlier stuff, because, you know, sometimes that's the deal, where the earlier records are what made them popular, and then they have like the big record. But you are familiar, so what do you think?
Yeah, actually, like, it's like when you said that, I was like, wait a minute, I've never listened to their old stuff. I mean, I don't have time for anything anymore. I don't have time. I don't have the attention span for anything. So, a while ago, I heard I Am King. I liked it. I was like, oh, this is like way heavier than I expected, and way like more brutal. You know, the whole beatdown hardcore thing that's going on right now, where there's a lot of these like there's entombed sounding bands, and there's just these really like doomy. Even like Knocked Loose. Knocked Loose is that band. You know, we've heard some interviews with them, whatever, and they're kind of like just goofy dudes, but they're really, really heavy and kind of brutal sounding by old standards. And I think that there's a disconnect between then and now, because I don't know what happened where this is mainstream music now.
Yeah, it's super weird.
I have no idea what screw fell out in the system that lets... And one of the things that always mystifies me, and there's even a couple of like local bands where they do this music where it's almost like Godflesh heavy, but I don't think that they listen to Godflesh. I don't think they even listen to, you know, like the Swans. I don't know how they got there. And these bands, when you like read interviews with them, they're like, well, who are your influences? Well, we like Warzone and Madball. What? You know, like, how did you get to this sound from that? Yeah. What led you there? What am I missing? When we were young, you know, and there's like metalcore bands, there would be a guy in the band who was somehow knowledgeable about like at least Slayer, maybe Exodus, or maybe they were like they just had a straight metal guy. A lot of bands had
if it was more than that, it was very clear. Like, you could look at the band and say, that's the guy.
That's the guy. There's the long hair shred guitarist is the guy who brought literal like Shadows Fall, like any of those really metalcore bands. There's a guy who brought Cannibal Corpse influences into the metalcore band. And I don't think that happens anymore. I don't know what the mechanism of action is, but there's no way that you get to the sound of Code Orange without crossing, you know, a bunch of Disembodied and all these other bands that are like, were like really brutal heavy like that. But they don't ever talk about that. I don't know if it's to hide their tracks or what, but, yeah, I've never listened to any of their old stuff. As far as I'm concerned, it is pop punk. Like, they went from being a pop punk band on their old albums to suddenly being this, you know.
There's definitely some 25-year-old that's listening to this is so fucking pissed off that, like, we have never listened to their old stuff either.
I invite their conversation, because I want to know what their foundations are.
Yeah.
Like, if you're a person who's 25, 26 right now, and you listen to what they call metalcore, the really hardcore version, I'm not talking about, like, Attila, but, like, the stuff that we're calling hardcore these days, and that is this heavy and this brutal. Like, I like Harm's Way. I like all this stuff. Just keep, you know, I like Nails. I like all these bands. They're so heavy. They're ridiculous. By the standards of anything I would listen to when I was a kid, these bands are impossibly heavy.
Yeah.
They're heavier than some of the death metal that's out right now. I don't get it. I don't know how you got there. I want to know. Let me know.
I will say, I guess I do have a little experience with this. I forgot.
Yeah.
As I earlier mentioned, the band Zabalba, which was the first band of that ilk that I heard, where I was like, the fuck? Like, what are these kids doing? Like, this is fucking ridiculous. And I've later on in my life have befriended one of the dudes from Zabalba. And, well, he's not in Zabalba anymore.
Holy shit.
Yeah, he wasn't in Zabalba. He's not in Zabalba anymore. He quit. But he moved to New York, and we used to go to wrestling together and stuff. So,
yeah.
But, like, you know, like, knowing him, I can understand it now. He was just, like, a dude who's just, like, into everything, basically. So,
yeah.
It kind of makes sense. Like, he's super into hip-hop, he's super into rap, he's super into metal. Like, you know, I think it kind of makes sense. Like, I think these kids, like, I think it's the same reason these bands get popular now. It's because it's so much easier to find them. Like, when we were younger and kids would listen to, I don't know, like fucking Korn or whatever, mm-hmm. or, you know, like, and they thought that was like the heaviest thing on the planet. It was just because there's no way to find the actual heavy music, and now it's so easy.
Like anybody who wants to talk about it, borderboss@gmail.com, borderbossRIP on Twitter and Instagram. Like, I'm dead curious. Give me the timeline. And I know people can do this. I know that there's like, I missed a lot. I missed many years of hardcore. And we'll actually get to this in this episode. There is like a sharp dividing line where I kind of checked out of this kind of music for a while. And they just kind of got back into being into death metal and, you know, Steely Dan or whatever. Like, and let this, and I just, and I'm old now, so I don't have to play shows that much anymore. Like, it doesn't matter to me anymore. I don't have to stay abreast of things. But when I popped my head back in and it was really good and really cool and really heavy and really scary and like oppressive and dense, that's cool. I'd like to know what 7-inch you bought that told you to behave this way.
You know what? You know what? I don't get. Speaking of that, though, there's another band that I believe you've heard called Vane, right? You listened to them, and they're like getting like a backlash now. Where after their new record, like these same kids are like, no, this has gone too far. Yeah, this is ridiculous. Just like, I don't understand it.
I don't get it either. I listen to it. I'm like, and people are saying, oh, this is so new metal now. This is so played out. I don't know what the fuck new metal you guys were buying.
Yeah, man, like, I don't understand why this is where they draw the line. Code Orange, that was fine. Knocked Loose, that was fine. Yeah. These guys, though, they're just too over the line.
There's some stuff in there. There's, like, some great beats and some corny stuff, but...
There's definitely some groovy bass lines in there, but, yeah.
There's nothing on that would have been on, like, a Linkin Park album. I mean, I guess, I don't really listen to System of a Down. Maybe System of a Down had a really
highly influenced
album.
By System of a Down. Vane.
Mudvayne? I don't know. Yeah.
I think that's just, like, that kid opinion where, like, one older boy said it. That was cool. And then
one person. For sure. One person said, this sounds like new metal to me. And that
took off.
It's kind of a bummer that it can be that easy now. Like, I won't do anything. I'm not going to do anything. I'm never going to be in a band again. I'm never going to like put myself out there. Border Boss is so safe because nobody listens. So it's like not a big deal. But, you know, if you put yourself, if you're a young person right now and you put your heart into something and like one dickhead on Twitter can tank you when you are at the top. Vane is at the top. They are like the number one hardcore band in the world. And they just got turned into dog shit overnight because of like one tweet somewhere in the world. That's incredible.
The same thing happened to that Twitching Tongues band. We both are on record not really liking that band, but again, like I polled a bunch of people on the internet, like, hey, why doesn't anybody talk about this band anymore? And oh, they suck now. And it's like, I guess.
Maybe we can claim credit for that. So if anybody was like lurking the 518 board 8 to 10 years ago and you got that tweet, you got that opinion from us, let me know because I'd love to take credit for bringing
the older boys.
The wise older boys who told you that Twitching Tongues should probably sing better. All right, I'll stick with the general. My personal has a better ending story anyway, so I'll stick with general and I'll let you know that first of all, somewhere out there on the internet, I encountered some people who are 10 minutes younger than me, who were talking positively about the first Marilyn Manson album. I couldn't believe it. And Mike, you're 10 minutes younger than me, so you're going to, and I know you already, I know you're already ready. You're ready to just tear me up.
I'm ready.
And you do it, you know, talk over me. I don't give a shit. I don't know what to do about this. You know, we're in an era now where people who listen to Limp Bizkit are adults who show no signs. You know, you could be next to someone right now who has a briefcase that grew up really, really, really into Power Man 5000. You know, that we're so far into that now. And I'm used to that feeling. I get that. Like, that doesn't bother me anymore. But this, I don't know. I don't understand how this album could have been any good. So I gave it a shot. And I'm game. This all holes filled. I am game. If something is good, I'm going to say that it's good. But I knew Marilyn Manson. He stands for all things Twizzy, and I knew, you know. But I know that at some point or another, he really liked David Bowie and tried to do some like glam rock stuff with his thing. So I was like, you know, maybe it's in there. Maybe I'm gonna find it. And I put on the album, and I'm positive this phenomenon predates all of us. But there's something about all like poor, sad, underserved fake mall goths who have to grow up in the shadow of Tim Burton. where they're like endlessly fascinated by the dark and twisted things that happen in kids' movies. You know what I mean? Like this is still going on, like Suicide Squad. You know, like Harley Quinn from that movie is the living embodiment of thinking that it's like radical insight to realize that dolls are creepy. You know, there's a secretary right now where you work who still is 100% certain that she's the only person in the office who noticed that the Animaniacs tell dirty jokes.
Yeah.
You know, like that's.
Or the one woman that thinks she's, her friends think she's like Daria.
Yeah. Yeah. The friend thinks like Daria. And maybe she has a book on Wicca. But, like this fucking album opens up with like a student performance of Willy Wonka Tunnel.
You didn't mention the name of the album. You should
get that. So we're talking about Marilyn Manson's, Portrait of an American Family. The first album, they had other stuff, but the first major album by Marilyn Manson after they shook off the name Marilyn Manson and the Spooky Kids and their fans became the Spooky Kids. And it opens with the Willy Wonka Tunnel song done as like to the max. Like someone really like, I think that this is this craziest shit that's ever been in a kids movie and I'm going to like live it. That's for me, that's unforgivable, but then it leads into a song called Cake and Sodomy. So, dude, I was there for 1994. I was alive. I was awake. I was grown. I remember the whole like children's show goth deal was well and truly explored by then. Like, you know, hardcore kids were already wearing Winnie the Pooh socks and wanting to be called Muffin while they were crowd killing. Like that shit was already done. Like being cutesy and being also like spooky, that was done. So what the fuck? Like when you bought this album, was it cool? Like, I know you like Willy Wonka and Marilyn Manson. I like Willy Wonka.
So I'll give my background with this album. I'm a couple two, three years younger than Scott.
Yeah.
And I think that's his main problem with this album is that this came
I'm
at
40 minutes older than you. And yeah. I can't ever bridge the gap.
It came at a very formative time. I was still in high school. I think that makes it pretty important. And, there was basically in my high school, there was, roughly around 20 kids that were into some sort of underground genre of music. And since it was the 90s, you're kind of like into all of it. And so you're kind of like cool with each other, or at least in my school. I don't know if that was everywhere, but
yeah.
So, you know, you'd have the kids that were like mostly into metal. Then there's some kids that were mostly in industrial music, some kids in hardcore, some kids in punk, even like some kids in fucking ska. And, Marilyn Manson had like a slow build. They had like a couple singles first, and I honestly think it was a solid 6 months or something from like their first video being played on Headbangers Ball or whatever 120 minutes or Super Rock or wherever the fuck they started playing the videos first to like the actual record release, which was in the summer. So yeah, it was like the full school year again pumped for this Marilyn Manson. And another thing people neglect to remember is that there was no internet, there was no Twitter back then. So a video would just pop up on MTV and that would be it. There would be no context. It would just be like, that's a video. And then, you know, they just move on to another video and you're just like, what the fuck was that? So,
or there'd be like a weird segment on MTV Music News and then no way for you to fulfill it.
Yes.
Like they would talk, cause that's how I was with some other bands. I'll admit it, that Primus, the band Primus got press on Music News way before, Frizzle Fry came out. And I was like, wow, that's really weird. I want to know more about that. There's just no way. There's no way for you to find out any more about that. You're dead in the water. So that happened constantly.
Yeah. So, like I think Dope Hat or Lunchbox, I think was the first video. And then I think Dope Hat was after that. And so there he was like building up like this infamy between, you know, all of the underground music kids. And it was like there was almost like you could say a new metal for us to sample, because like back then it was just like them, and then Korn came. Korn was around the same time. I can't remember who was first, but you know that was before the term nu metal was coined. So this is like the proto nu metal, and people tend to forget that. And you know, honestly, long story short, we were all like anticipating it. It came out. I listened to it. I was like, this is not my shit. This is not for me. It's like a little too slow, a little too over. It's crazy listening to it now, but back then being like, this is too much shit going on. This is too overproduced. Now listening to it, I'm like, this is pretty raw for what I was thinking. But you know, it was one of those things back then. I bought the cassette. So I was going to find the most positive parts I could about it, because there was no way I was going to hate something I spent $13 on.
Right. You have to figure out a way to enjoy it. Like I was still, you know, I was in college and I was still young enough to know that something was going on, but I was like checking out by then. I wasn't, you know, college TV doesn't give you anything really like MTV to watch or anything like that. And I was really into ska and trying to be a jazz guy and also trying to be like really into like screamo and stuff like that, which was a different version of what's out now. It's not the same thing, but I kind of shrugged off metal. But when I would go out with my friend to Taco Bell at the mall, and there'd be the kids with those like baggy strappy black pants, you know, that just had like random straps hanging off of them and stuff like that, and they'd be wearing like mesh on their arms. It's like, what's going on right now? Like these kids are like, they're not listening to Nitzer Ebb or something. What are they doing that's getting them here? So I knew something was going on. I didn't have like the time or the money or the interest to ever figure it out. And like, I didn't even know that there was Marilyn Manson videos at this point. I never saw one until Beautiful People or whatever the Eurythmics one where he rides around on a pig. That's like those. One of those is the first time I ever finally encountered what was going on with Marilyn.
I think
Manson.
He even had, this was back when people had like prominent B-sides, and one of the singles had him covering Cars by Gary Numan, and I'm pretty sure even that had a video at the time.
That had to be like within a couple years of when Fear Factory did it as well. So, you know, I guess everyone was just hearing like same thing. All of a sudden, everyone's like, remember New Wave, dude? So, you know, when I get to my next album, you're going to realize that I'm willing to meet an album halfway. I'm willing to like, I knew that there was going to be clearly audible lyrics that were trying to be cartoon shocking. I didn't know it was going to be this like skin crawling that I was going to listen to this album and be like, wow, really? Like, how old was he? He was an adult by now, right?
He was a young adult.
He wasn't like 19 though. He was in his 20s at least.
I think he was in his 20s. Yes.
Okay. I'll give him some leeway. I'm sincerely not holding that against this album. So what puzzles me is that, honestly, like maybe it's because I'm listening to this album through earbuds or whatever, but it's not heavy.
Update, it was Down in the Park. I just don't want people to call me.
Oh, well, that's pretty sick. Yeah. Down in the Park's a sick cover.
Yeah.
This album isn't really heavy. It's not really like scary or edgy. It's like really smooth. Like for the other than some samples and some noises that happen, this is pretty smooth rock. There's like a lot. Like in 1994, the year this came out, I think like the Stone Temple Pilots album is sonically heavier than this album. It's like pretty unchallenging. I mean, it's not even really nu metal yet. I guess it's nu metal in the fact that the guitar drops out in the verse and the bass just keeps going do 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 while he, you know, does whatever he's thinking.
I think Marilyn Manson, the second album, which I fucking hate, was like the big introduction to the, like the regular world of Marilyn Manson. And I think by then he saw the writing on the wall that there was no future nu metal. So.
Yeah. So he there's really only a few bands that I think fall into whatever this is. Like, I mean, I kind of think Rob Zombie's the same thing.
Yeah.
White
and
Zombie.
And they were a band that kind of just like stepped in shit and got famous out of nowhere. I don't think they were as calculated as Marilyn Manson was, that's for sure.
So I gave this album a college try. I wouldn't say I hate it. I don't really get, you know, what drove like legitimately edgy, you know, searching angry children to find it. It's pretty, the whole first half of the album is actually kind of low energy. It's kind of dull and kind of low energy.
It was really just this, you know, the like iconography and stuff like that, I think.
Yeah, well, the
really
cover is definitely like prime 90s twizzy, you know, it's like puppets or something like that.
That's what it, I mean, now thinking like in retrospect, it is weird because I do agree with Scott. I think this record's great, and I do think it's not in like any of my personal top 10 lists, but when it shows up on like Rolling Stone's best heavy metal, I'm like, fine. I understand it was like a huge impact. But yeah, it's just like, it doesn't have that, I don't know what I'm trying to say, basically. Basically what Scott was saying, I guess.
It's not low quality. It's definitely not low quality. I wouldn't say that. And I think that Marilyn Manson, the vocals himself, he delivers, like he's a mature front man or something. Like his delivery is really kind of like he had gotten it down somehow. You know, his like growling, his cock rock, whatever his vocals are supposed to be. He was actually like, he's really good at the whisper singing, the spooky whisper singing and like all that shit. So, you know, the whole album is kind of like this mid-paced rock and the verses are just bass and like noises. It's like basically like what Linkin Park made so much money on later on. You know, just having like all the noises drop out and it's just the bass and vocals. That's every song. That's the verse of every song. Then halfway through, it kind of picks up. Like this album actually kind of picks up, I think. And there's a song, Dogma, that I think kind of rocks. It's like not a bad song. It's just kind of like a punk song, but it's got some cool, super heavy. I'm not going to cue this up anytime soon. I'm not going to go back to it, but it's got some oomph. It's got some banging parts. There's dumb samples because it's the 90s. Everybody was putting just like Primacy samples all over their stuff or whatever. But in this one, it spices up the song. It does a good job. You know, all of alt rock was about having like random shit over the top of your otherwise ordinary song. And, this album is way, way into that. I don't know. Was this prior to everybody getting sued for using samples on things? Because this is basically this is like a Paul's Boutique of bullshit.
Yeah, just, I think movie samples are still fair game at that point, though. It was more music samples that were.
Really, the point of contention here is the song My Monkey. I thought for sure this was some old times filler throwaway track. Because in the old days, you had to fill an album. Like if you had a record deal, you had to make an album.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of instances of this. I was talking to another friend earlier who pointed out that, you know, even Black Sabbath did it in the 70s. Like they just threw a couple of like solos on there, like just to fill the album because they were supposed to put out an album. And then 30 years later, everyone thinks it's a classic. But at the time, it was bullshit. They were stoned and they just like filled it up. I thought this was that because it sounds like that. It sounds like filler music. It sounds like that. Remember the reality show with Scott Ian and Billy and Evan Seinfeld?
Oh,
and
they Sebastian? Made the band. Yeah,
they made the band Damnation. And yeah, you know, when that band, the first time they jam, it's just like do 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 do. Play something, man. Like if you just right now turn over to your bassist and say play something, man, he's gonna play My Monkey. And they went with it. And then the whole thing is like cartoon jokey vocals and a bunch of samples. And it screams filler track. But Mike, you sent me a link. They've been working on this. They demoed this.
Yeah, this was a previous Marilyn Manson and Spooky Kids song.
Yeah, totally premeditated. This is an existing song that they actually worked on. So, you know, I mean, this wouldn't have won me over when I was a child. I was into other stuff beyond this. I don't have any frame reference for this. I can't even think of what else was going on at the time that this was like related to. So I guess I give it credit for that. Like this is kind of its own.
I mean, this
unit.
This was definitely at the height of Nine Inch Nails popularity too, when they were coasting off of that too.
I think a lot of people coast on Nine Inch Nails because the first time I ever heard the Korn, we actually ended up with a Korn tape of just like a few songs. It had Blind. Is there a song called Clown?
Something like that. Kooky but Clown, I think it's called.
Yeah. And the way that he sings, I was like, this sounds like Trent Reznor to me. And there's a lot of stuff where like the singer is shy and he's just going, he's just like poop grunting into a mic. And
But like Marilyn Manson, it was like Trent Reznor discovered these guys. It was like a deal like that. So they already.
It's the first album actually on Nothing. It's on like Nothing.
I think it is actually. I think it might be.
Well, that changes everything. Now that there's an industrial connection, I changed my entire review. Yeah.
That was the thing. Hopefully Scott just cuts it out. But I lost my train of thought earlier.
Yeah.
And that's what I was. What's so strange listening back at this is that my one friend, the one friend that actually got super, you know, super obsessed with Marilyn Manson, buying all the fucking foreign singles, and he's probably how I knew My Monkey had a demo because he probably bought that, you know, overpriced $23 bootleg CD that they sell at CD stores that had like the Marilyn Manson demo on it. He was previously to the Marilyn Manson fame or obsession, he exclusively wore Metallica shirts to school. This was not a time when Metallica was cool. It was before they before they made Load, but it was in that middle time where like no one really gave a shit about Metallica.
Yep.
And so we were just like, who's that weird kid that wears Metallica shirts every day? But you know, then he became our friend, and then yeah, it was nothing but Marilyn Manson shirts after that. But then he got into black metal, but still loved Marilyn Manson. And that was a time when you could do that without being ridiculed, I think. But it's still like you can tell it was completely just the imagery, because there's nothing to grab you if you are a spooky satanic kid outside of the imagery.
Like it, you could have Cradle of Filth as your bridge because it's exactly halfway between black metal.
That's why people get into Cradle of Filth too. Yeah. I think Cradle of Filth for what they are. Maybe I'll do a Cradle of Filth episode.
We can do a Cradle. There's a song called. Listen, everybody, stop what you're doing. Put on the song "Twisted Nails of Faith." skip up until the guitar breaks down. That riff is so sick. There's like the sickest riff of all time on that.
That's the thing. I haven't heard like tons of Cradle of Filth. From what I've heard, I'm like, I can understand how kids like from the mall get into this, because this is like, if you're in the mall and you hear this, that's like the sickest shit ever.
Yeah, it's a little too much. It's a little too much, like, if you're already kind of, like, lingering in that world.
Yeah, you're like, okay.
But if, you know, it's the same thing I'm saying. It's like, you know, the fact that that's kind of, like, a mainstream choice to listen to Cradle of Filth. All their imagery and all their t-shirts aside, that is still legitimate black. That's, like, still, like, sounds like there's a guy barking like a chihuahua over, like, an orchestra. That's not normal. That's not, like, normal music. And, you know, we've let that slide a little bit to where that's, like, a poser choice now. Okay, I'll give you that. I'm there with you, but wow.
So my personal pick is a record from, sorry, I'm looking it up right now just to make sure.
You're looking up what your pick was?
No, I just want to see when it was released. It was released apparently right at the end of 1999. It's a record called The Opposite of December by a band called Poison the Well.
Oh shit. I can't believe it's 1999, honestly. That's
Yeah, I know. It's kind of like, you're just like, whoa. But for those who don't personally know me, I'm I don't know if I would say I'm an expert on metalcore, but I'm pretty close. I know good about metalcore, 90s moshcore into 2000s metalcore. But there was, like, unfortunately for me, as much like Scott's story about kind of drifting in and out in the late 90s and early 2000s, I did drift out. I was still listening to music, but I wasn't really seeking it out. And so I kind of missed the transition from basically like Earth Crisis to Jane Doe, basically. I missed that whole connection of how did we get here? Mm-hmm. How did we get to guys who can play their instruments and stuff like that?
Right.
And so I kind of did catch up. Aaron from our band kind of was the one who would usually send me stuff and be like, oh, you should listen to this. I mean, I had heard the Killswitch Engage demo before I knew Poison the Well existed, that's for sure. And that was like, I remember hearing that and being like, this is insane for mosh music.
Right.
So, you know, I heard like that type of metalcore, but there was never like any connection. I knew of Cave In and like how great they were, but I never firsthand got into the Trustkill vein of metalcore. Yeah. So I was never listened to Poison the Well or anything like that, or even knew that they were a huge popular band until years later. And they're mostly a band that's synonymous with a song on this record called Nerdy.
Yeah.
So I've heard that song thousands of times.
Yeah.
And every single time I'm just like, I don't get it. Like, how is this the song for this band that is supposed to be this seminal metalcore band? Mm-hmm. I was on some fucking site called Loudwire or something like that.
Right.
Ranked this like the number two metalcore record of all time.
Oh, it gets all kinds. This is like so highly regarded.
Yes. And, you know, I'm just like, maybe I missed out. Like, I've heard the record after this is Something Turns Red, or I don't know, October Burns Red, I think it's called. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe that's a fucking typo negative record. I can't think. It's
From Autumn to Ashes.
Something Rust. It's like October Turns to Rust. I don't know. It's something like that. But I've heard that and I was like, ah, fuck. So I was like, I guess I could listen to this and, you know, see if I could connect the dots of what I've been missing this year, all this time. And, you know, I kind of can. Like, I can kind of see the progression of what happened. And it just boggles my mind that a band would voluntarily want to play music like this. And it's just like, I don't know. It's like, it's so, like Scott has said it, it's so smooth and just so clean. And there's nothing.
Yeah, there's no snags to this. And it almost seems like, I think we were talking about some other band, but I was like, you know, if nobody wants to sing and the guitarist is like, well, I'll sing.
Yeah.
And they don't do a great job. Like, that's what this sounds like, is the whole band is just five guys saying, well, I guess I'll do that. Like, I guess I'll play bass in your metalcore. I guess I'll play guitar. It's so filler. Like, there's a genre. This birthed a genre, basically. I don't know if this is the very first thing, but this broke with the whole thing where you had to kind of be good at something.
Yeah.
You could be five guys who just had decent equipment and were willing to, you know, scream over mid-paced, smooth, octave chord rock, and voila, you were a metalcore band. There's a learning curve just vanished.
Yeah.
And we had, like, people, like, proud warriors such as me had spent so long leading up to this, trying to like build a standard of quality into metalcore that was just rapidly flushed out.
But
like,
yeah,
it just vanished
so
overnight.
It's strange listening to it now and just like seeing the growth, because it's just so, I don't know. It's like Cave-In. Cave-In already had two records at this point. And, you know, time moved a lot slower back then. It could be a full year before you got wind of a band. So I'm not going to say, oh, you know, everybody should have heard of Cave-In before they heard of Poison the Well. But for people who heard both, I don't know why you would take that direction over Cave-In. Like, it's just like, it's insane to me that people were like, we should start more bands that sound like this. I can understand them being like the one band that sounded like this and then just going nowhere. And maybe, you know, they'd have a novel record out of it. But yeah, it did spark like a whole genre. And it's like crazy in hindsight. And the only thing I think of, it is for, I think Scott alluded to it, but it's for like those affluent kids that were just like looking for like underground music. Mm-hmm. It's nice, like nice and clean for them. And I bet I could guarantee you anybody that thinks this is like a seminal record probably has a better job and makes more money than me. Like I can guarantee they have like their hidden tattoos. They have the fucking naval star tattoos somewhere,
right,
or like the sparrows on their chest. But outside of that, they're just fucking regular dads right now.
Yeah,
I can almost guarantee that's every Poison the Well fan.
That's the cool, like when they're in meetings, you know, disruptive tech meetings. It's the fact that they're the 39-year-old guy who has a full sleeve is the talking point or whatever.
Yeah, that's pretty much it, man. And like I guess I respect it. Like it's hard. I think me and Scott set out to like one of the indicators for this podcast is to be like, would we have liked this when we heard, you know, when we were actually of age. And it's tough. Like, I don't think there's anything on here that really would have grabbed me. Like, in hindsight, I listened to it. I'm like, the drums don't even knock on this. They're just kind of shitty. But, like, you know, I'm not, like, listening through 1999 airs either. So, I don't know if I would think that in 1999. But like, I think it would be one of those calls where if I bought it, I would force myself to like it. But if I was listening to this for free, I would have just skipped over it. So, it's just like, I don't know. It's definitely a negative for me, but I just can't believe, like, listening back to it, that so many bands wanted to be Poison the Well.
I did buy it. I did buy it for money, because it's as I was talking about earlier, there's a transitional period for me where I was super, super into what was leading out of the 90s. I really loved Dead Guy, and I really loved Cave-In, and I really loved Converge and Coalesce and all these like crazy, like unhinged bands.
Yeah.
And I think all of them, I don't know if they had to get lucky or what, but all of them have like a spark, like something about them that was crazy.
Yeah.
You know, like Jake Bannon, even though live he's kind of like whatever, like he's pretty wild on albums. And, you know, the guys who write the music around him are very wild. And Cave-In, the composition was super wild. You know, that guy was a genius. You know, he went in a way I didn't like after that, but he's still a genius. And, Coalesce with their crazy time signatures and their singer who, you know, allegedly smoked cigars to make himself sing better. That's sick. That's like, that's lucky that you ended up in that situation. Even like Integrity. Integrity's older, but having those vocals in front of your band saves you. Ringworm.
Yeah.
Like having the Human Furnace guy singing for your band saves everything else that you're doing underneath it. Like, I think that there's a point at which you didn't need any spark, and it's like a whole like kind of EVR thing. We had some local bands. It remains to be seen whether I'll feel like putting anyone on blast. Nobody listens to this anyway. But there were some local bands who were doing this kind of smooth, unchallenging metalcore.
Even our local band was doing this before we were in.
Yeah, before we joined a band all at once. Like, we just took over. Several people all of a sudden just took over a band from some younger boys. We kept one of the younger boys because he was a phenomenal drummer. And we made like a, you know, like a crazy metalcore band out of it, like basically like a Darkest Hour type thing or something like that. But prior to that, they were doing octave chords and mid-paced, you know, screaming, featureless
but
deserts,
I mean, even,
of hard, whatever you call it, emo, like post-emo or something like
but
that.
But even them, you know, us, you know, before we were in the band, they had the one song with the breakdown in it, and that was like even that was more of a spark than anything I see on Poison the Well. Like, it's just like, I don't know. There's that nerdy song isn't...
The like nerdy song is 45 seconds. Like, the intro, like, the, you know, the...
Yeah.
The Snap Casey kind of, like, whatever you call it, like, it's got some edge to it. That's the song. Like, you.
And then there's, you know, there's a fucking mosh part, but it's like, I would give it a 6 out of 10. And that's not yeah. enough to be, if you type in Poison the, it's going to autofill Well Nerdy. Like, it's yeah. not even just Poison the Well, it's Poison the Well Nerdy. So it's just crazy that this band is, like, that iconic for this song that's really not that great.
Yeah, there's, like, a, you know, there's bands that were in that same era who were kind of, like, superior even at the time. But even them, like, so there's, like Shai Hulud.
Yeah.
You know, they're kind of sort of in the same ilk, but they had, you know, they had more oomph to them. And they still had, like, Profound Hatred of Man is the same thing. It starts off with a sick riff, and then they get tired of playing the awesomest part of the song and just go into, like, like dull metalcore. You know, like, that was, like, a thing to do, is, like, have your whole reputation be based on the sickest opening part of your hit, and then the rest of your hit from 45 seconds onward is just nonsense. It's just like metalcore nonsense, and then it goes to like a mosh part that's kind of cool and rides out, and you know, people go bananas. I don't know, I totally broke with all this music at this time. I didn't listen to any, I don't know anything, and you know, pick some names, whether I'm wrong or right, but I didn't listen to 18 Visions. I didn't listen to Hope Conspiracy. I didn't listen to any of the stuff that was kind of in this 1999 to probably like 2003 or whatever. And I lost track of all metalcore, and it was kind of boring. And then all of a sudden, all my friends were listening to like Mind Eraser and Iron Age and all these bands that are crazy. Like what, where did this come from? Like, you guys are like, all of a sudden, you know, like Power Violence, but influenced by super heavy, you know, crust punk or whatever is back, and stuff sounds kind of like Dystopia again or whatever. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
And people are just listening to it like it's like as though it was just Bad Brains or Fear or something like that. I'm like, what happened? Why did you guys get so? And I think that's because this is my, I don't know this for a fact, but basically, you know, if a soft, weak thing gets a little bit too big, larger forces are gonna climb into its carcass and wear it. And metalcore became Suicide Silence, Attila, yeah. Thy Art Is Murder, earlier Job for a Cowboy, you know, all these bands that just decided they were metalcore. They had no moral center. They had no politics. They had no connection to the scene or whatever. They just adopted metalcore. And like, that's it. That's what metalcore is now.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a dirty word now. It has no relationship at all to actual hardcore anymore. It's divorced entirely. It's attack. And stuff yeah. that came after that.
I think the best example of that is friends of mine, like the Acacia Strain. They were a yeah. band that kind of crossed over from the our brand of metalcore to the just da-da-dun.
Yeah.
Da-da-dun. And
that's new metal. To me, that stuff sounds kind of like new metal. And
yeah, but no, Vain is too new metal though.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say that whole like that branch of metalcore is like, I don't think anybody who would listen to a Vane or Code Orange even like they don't even rate that music anymore now. Yeah,
no, there's
that's
no
like
connection.
A whole other scene, yeah.
Yeah, there's no connection. It's basically just that all of metalcore showed weakness, and a stronger, more superior man came along.
Yeah,
made it do its bidding, and that's it. Now there's like. Now there's so many branches of things, it doesn't connect at all. And I don't think I actually don't know if even the bands that we are calling hardcore, I don't know if Code Orange, I don't know if Knock Loose, I don't know if Turnstile, I don't know, are they actually like into the ethics and the sort of...
I think that's what it is, because I mean, I remember when I first got into hardcore, it was like rapidly changing. And I think it's yeah. just kind of doing that again, where it's like... I only knew if a band was hardcore by either if they had breakdowns or somebody told me they're hardcore.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of what it is now. And it's just like, it's basically kids who go like who play DIY shows still, basically.
Yeah. Well, my personal choice this week was, this may be a surprise, and it shouldn't be a surprise. Don't ever be surprised by my metal choices. I'm aware of almost all metal stuff between 82 and like 2002 and then, you know, ongoing. But I never grew up with kids who had Bathory shirts or like rainbow back patches. Like that old, that like knowledge of the past that just didn't exist. Like I was a kid going to a school where there was like 8 metalheads and we were all friends and we all had the same tapes. So like by the time I was getting into metal, everybody had at least the baseline was the Slayer Do You Want to Die shirt. If you didn't have that or above, nobody knew what the hell you were doing that day. Like if you came to school in a Venom shirt, nobody knew what you were doing. It didn't make any sense to anybody. So by the time I became a formal metalhead at like 13 or 14, I skipped right to Metallica and Anthrax. I never had any access to Merciful Fate. Merciful Fate, Melissa. My choice is Merciful Fate, Melissa. And, you know, don't think I didn't know who King Diamond was. Everybody knows who King Diamond was. Everyone has always known who King Diamond was. You know, we knew about him in his makeup. I read Metal Maniacs. I read Rip Magazine. He was always in there, you know, but I want everybody to take a deep breath. Take a deep breath and do a little role play with me. Try to imagine you are an overly serious thrash lord in 1993, the pre-internet vacuum of 1993. Really try. Like, give me some space here. Try to embody the role of like a sad, overweight teen with a mullet when all your friends have cooler hair and you have a fluffy Lars Ulrich mullet. You have an enormous stick up your ass about metal. And now cue up the video from Merciful Fate's Egypt. And be serious with me, you know? You're like, if you're primed to dig on King Diamond, this is fine. He had his own thing going on vocally. And, you know, it's a conceit. You're either down with it or you're not. It's very silly. King Diamond is very silly sounding. And I say this with love in my heart, like full hindsight. I'm here. Like, I'm in 20, you know, I know the same shit you know about modern appreciation of retro metal. I know, like, I listen to Sirith Ungol and all these bands that, like, that kind of sound shitty. It doesn't bother me. You got to shake out those cobwebs and really peer into the fact that King Diamond sings like a Muppet. There's no, like Steve Austin from Today's the Day. He sings like a Muppet too, but it's like a frayed, like, damaged, destroyed, unhinged, wild version of like a black metal Muppet or something like that. That's not King Diamond. King Diamond's singing like actually like a Muppet, you know, and I feel like he's like at the best you could say he's doing a legitimate like Earth, Wind, and Fire falsetto, you know, like a disco falsetto in metal. I don't know what everybody was thinking because he stayed famous. You know, he stayed on top. Like, this worked.
Forever.
Forever. To this day, it worked. He's still doing it. And not only that, he influenced bands to do that. Not Merciful Fate influenced everybody, of course, because the guitar work, like, it's great. If you buy, I think it's Nine Equilibrium by Emperor, they were like a top-notch, state-of-the-art black metal band, and there's a part, all of a sudden, where in a song, he goes, "No remorse." Nobody asked him to do that. Nobody authorized that. That's King Diamond. He's like, just wanted to be King Diamond, like, in the middle of an album. You know, so... First of all, the cover art rules. The cover of this album is so good. Like, it's so good I have to, like, take a moment because I might start getting a little, like, misty. I don't know how they lucked into this. Because you look at the other covers. They're cool. They're demons. They're skulls. Awesome. That's fine. But it's the same artist. And this one is just, like he stayed up really late one night and just kept eating his fermented fish or whatever they eat wherever he's from. And he nailed it. Like, if you have managed to get to 2018 without seeing the cover of Merciful Fate's Melissa, it's a really well-painted skull with demon horns, and it's apparently moving so fast that it's like shedding lava or neon. It's trailing behind it, and it looks almost like a synthwave album that would be out now. You know, it's one of the best metal album covers of all time, and I'm pretty sure that that's what got them through the door. Like, this album cover is what made people give them a chance. And it's named Melissa. Like, that's pretty neat. You know, it was originally called Into the Coven. If this album had come out, it was called Merciful Fate Into the Coven. Maybe, you know, maybe that would have worked, but there's something really compelling about putting out an extreme metal album with the sickest skull cover of all time and just naming it Melissa. That's cool. That's like, that makes me feel really good that they did that. and I know, like, I don't know if it was before or after, but he named the skull Melissa, like the skull that he carries around with him or whatever, and named Melissa. And I guess that got stolen. You know, so have you listened to this, Mike? Do you know anything about this album?
Yeah, I mean, I listened to it for the show. I did not ever listen to this beforehand.
Were you, like, familiar with, like, were you...
Yeah, I know what it is.
But had you listened to any King Diamond prior?
I mean, he has... What's the one song? He has the one song. Abigail.
Yeah, Abigail's his hit. That's basically the hit.
Yeah, I mean, I know the fucking hit. Yeah,
concept album is the hit.
Yeah.
It's not that heavy. It's really surprising because, like, the album is kind of classic rock sounding. It's pretty low gain guitars. And, you know, and this is, I think it's 83.
Yes.
Even cock rock albums at this time were pretty heavy. Like Shout at the Devil came out this year. Shout at the Devil's pretty heavy. Bark at the Moon. Think of the song Bark at the Moon. It's all like those skittery, like you need gain on your guitar to do that. So they had the pedal in the world. And if you read any of like, you know, if you read any of the rumors and legends about this, is that like Metallica and, you know, Slayer and whatever were super into this. Metallica was hanging out with them at the time and were like, oh, you guys sound so good. We want to borrow your amps. They were so into Merciful Fate's sound, they wanted to borrow it. I don't get that because, you know, like, even like Slayer had an album out this year. Slayer had two things out this. Suicidal Tendencies had something out this year. There was like plenty, there's plenty of heavy stuff. That's, it's not bad. It's not bad that this isn't super heavy. It's just odd that this is like a classic of, you know, black and extreme metal and whatever, because it's not heavy at all, but it's perfect. It's perfectly performed. This album is really precise. It's really well produced, especially for the time period. It holds up fine. It's like totally okay to listen to. Did you like it when you listened to it at all?
I listened to it and I was like, man, this is some pretty wild shit.
Yeah.
But I think this is very proto, you know, proto whatever the fuck it became.
Yeah. It's like,
a lot of it just seems like songs end. Like they're just like, we don't know where to go from here. There's like a lot of that on this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fine. It's 1983. My big thing with listening to this was kind of like your thing, where you're just like, you really never got a chance to listen to it.
Yeah.
Because you were like so far beyond, was that it's fucking crazy to me in 1983 how much this dude mentioned Satan and all this other satanic shit. And it's like during that time when, you know, there's news reports and whole 2020 episodes dedicated to stomping out this satanic metal menace. Mm-hmm. I've never heard Merciful Fate, and it's just like, you can tell they only did like a surface level job. They're like, oh, that kid listened to Judas Priest and he killed himself, so
yeah,
they're obviously the most satanic. So like, if I heard this in 1983, my mind would be blown. But I don't think you could, like, without cultivating a serious image, I don't think you could pull off like just discovering Merciful Fate in 2018. There is nothing there for like a modern person to be like, yeah, this is my shit. Like, maybe in later albums, but not this one.
One of the things that's weird about this album is that there's an arc. It's almost like they primed you for King Diamond on this album. Because the first album is more of the rougher vocals. He just kind of like cock rock growls his way through most of the song. And it's distinct. It's cool. He's another one. He came out of the gate with a swagger and like a propulsion. Kind of growl sings in his own range. That's great. It's really good. And then every now and then he just hits that little falsetto once in a while just to go like, I'm the king of pain. I'm insane. That's cool. Like, that's fine. Like, that's like, you know, it's like a little Rob Halford spice or something like that. That rocks. There's no problem with that. And then it just keeps going. Like a few songs more, he just keeps leaning more on that. Like, you know, the music is still totally on point. The compositions are really neat. There's layers. There's cool harmonies. There's changes. There's like a lot of stuff going on. And it's, you know, it's complicated metal for the time. But then there's just more and more King Diamonds. Like, they just keep adding King Diamonds, layers and layers of King Diamond. And they start to get less and less Rob Halford and more like Scooter from the Muppets. The more you go along in this album. And so, none of this is bad if you're in the right frame of mind, but you need to meet King Diamond halfway. Like, you know, I don't know how this flew. Like, I remember Hessians when I was a kid. They were terrifying. And I don't know, I can't see them being generous. And, you know, if you're 18 in 1983 and like you're like the big like mullet dude that like drives the forklift at the furniture store and has a brush in your back pocket, I don't know how you were nice enough to give King Diamond a wide berth like this, but you did. So that's interesting. But you know, most of this music is not evil. It's not really evil sounding. Like, it's just, there's a song called The Sound of the Demon Bell. That's at least 80% cock rock. The song is like Black Sabbath-y a little bit, but it's like swaggering, like bow, 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 bow. It's cock rock. It's the whole intro could be on like a Fastway album or even like Whitesnake. Like, that could have been on a cool Whitesnake album. I'm still not saying anything bad. Like, I haven't said anything bad about this. And I just think that by the time you get to the song Satan's Fall, you better have really embraced the King Diamond core product, because for the remainder of that album there's four King Diamonds at least, all singing like moody Disney Cinderella choruses. They're singing like heavenly King Diamond choruses behind this movie soundtrack imagery, And, you know, there's a song called Black Funeral, and the chorus is straight up, "Oh, hail Satan. Yes. Oh, hail Satan. Yeah. Oh, yes, Satan."
That was my track of the album. I would put that on a mixtape.
Yeah. And yeah. If you're just kind of letting it go on the background, that's the one that taps you on the shoulder. Hey, man, I'm on board, though. I'm still on board. I always kind of knew the band sounded a little bit older like this. This is my first time really soaking in the Vision. I'm not unhappy. I still always remember seeing the Egypt video as a teen. And personally, this album has a special this touches my life in a special way, because I went to high school with a dude. Every office has the spiderweb lady, right? You know, there's someone in every bleak, low-level job, every terrible job, every terrible, like, fluorescent-lit office has someone who one Halloween decides to let their freak flag fly. They come in wearing, like, a corset or platform cyber boots or their leather duster or finger armor, and they get away with it on Halloween, and something goes wrong inside, and they misread the room, and they think that they have a mandate to put a skull on their desk and start painting spider webs on their faces, like, day to day. And they maintain it. And now there's an actual witch working in the office with you. We had a dude who one Halloween came to school dressed as King Diamond. He it wasn't really a thing to dress up for Halloween in my school, especially when you're in the 11th and 12th grade. And, you know, by the time you're in 12th grade, you're basically 40. So you're not really supposed to be doing childish things anymore. He came dressed fully, and he came in like a really nice vampire cape, the red lining and the black on the outside that he had stitched and things on. He had a crossbone skull he was carrying around. He had full makeup. He had actually grown his hair into the pot. Like, he'd taken time. Like, this is a long game. This dude had the long game. He grew the pompadour. So he had King Diamond's hair. He had King Diamond's mustache that he painted over with makeup. And after that day, it was pretty routine for homeboy to just come to school in full King Diamond regalia. He just sit there in class, taking physics notes and looking like at any moment he was just going to go, "Grandma!" I'll send you a link. He's still out there.
I do have one more thing. Okay. Little project for the listeners.
Yeah.
I'm sure at least one listener out there will know the answer to this, but while I was doing some research on Merciful Fate, mm-hmm. if you had asked me when the final Merciful Fate album came out, I would probably say 1987, 1988. But it turns out they just kept cranking them out.
Yeah.
And they made like 6 albums in the 90s, I think.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to go through those albums, but I have a theory that almost every single metal band, at least had one new metal song during those lean late 90s years. So if any of you Merciful Fate experts out there want to let me know if that's true or not, because I'm not going to comb through the discography, but I bet there's one new metal leaning Merciful Fate song out there.
I'll fucking double down on this. If you could send me the new metal King Diamond song, a new metal Merciful Fate song that has King Diamond on it, and it's new metal and they did it, I'll give you $25.
Yeah, Scott is.
I don't think convinced. It exists.